It's a new year, bringing some new changes in federal law that affect our take-home pay and our taxes. And that'll be one of our hot topics on this week's edition of On Your Money. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine this week. It's Tuesday, January 8th, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Kevin McKinley is with us, as he is most Tuesdays at this time. He's a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He joins us from our studio in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello.
Some guy. Don't worry about
it. Sorry. Your name again?
I can't even keep track anymore. Ron. Rod. Rob.
Check
that's
your,
it.
Check your wallet.
How
are you, Rob?
Check my drive. I'm good. How are you, Kevin?
I'm well. Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
You too. How did
you?
Other
listeners out here and on your money land.
How did you celebrate your New Year, Kevin?
By sleeping.
Me too. I didn't make it to midnight.
Where that's one of the most enjoyable ways that I could think of. What I would wish for the new year for me and most of our other listeners is a little more sleep.
A little more sleep. Well, Congress and the president celebrated the new year by trying to come to terms with this fiscal cliff deal. These guys know how to party, I tell you. And that's what we're going to talk about to kick things off. How does this fiscal cliff agreement affect us, whether or not we're done talking and worrying about it?
It wasn't supposed to be like this. Way back over 10 years ago, these were really the Bush tax cuts, if you will, that were supposed to go into effect, and the originators of the cuts wanted them to be permanent. Other people said, you know what, this is going to cost too much money. We may actually run deficits if we keep these tax cuts and spending levels in place. So tell you what, let's have an expiration date on these things. They said, fine, and in 2010, that's when they were all supposed to expire. They kicked the can down the road for a couple of years, and finally they said, you know, we need a deadline in place, and the deadline needs to have some punishment. So it's going to be painful if we don't reach a new agreement. So what was going to happen is if the deadline came and went and a new agreement hadn't been reached, we were going to see $500 billion more in taxes and then $200 billion less in government spending, both of which would have probably helped the financial situation of the United States government, but would have hurt the economy quite a bit, especially in the short run. So negotiations, of course, went up to the last minute, and then they finally came to an agreement, and they got their names in the paper and the radio and TV and on the web for several days while people watched them walk in and out of offices with concerned looks on their faces.
And what were some of the key outcomes of what they did end up coming up with?
The changes were pretty small and very subtle. A few people are going to have slightly higher income taxes. There were some fixes to the alternative minimum tax, which will affect more people. A lot of extensions on some of the other taxes that were in place. But, and this is probably the most important one for a lot of people right now, is there were no cuts to federal spending yet.
And now where are we going to feel the tax increases?
We will feel it. Those of us who are working are going to be affected right away in our first paycheck because our Social Security withholding amounts are going to rise. There was a payroll tax holiday in place that was basically cutting 2% of our incomes off of what was going to be withheld for Social Security. So normally we have 6.2% of our incomes withheld for Social Security for workers, and that was reduced down to 4.2%. So there's a 2% rise on the percentage up to about $113,000 or so. So how this will work, people are making, say, $50,000 a year in 2013. They will pay about $1,000 more per year in Social Security taxes than if the extension, the payroll holiday, had been allowed to continue. Now, there are some other things for people who have much higher income in the $200,000 to $500,000 level. They are going to pay even more in taxes. They're going to lose some deductions. And we'll talk about some of those other changes in our smart asset segments later on in the show.
Well, the great thing, Kevin, is now that they've reached this deal, it's done and we'll never, ever have to talk about this again, right? And please say I'm right.
I don't even know why they'll meet in Congress anymore, just to, you know, to talk about the new year and vacations and compare tans. And I don't think they'll have any other reason. No, of course this isn't done. The ink wasn't even dry on the agreement and the next fight already started. This is about the debt ceiling, how much the federal government is allowed to borrow. In the past, what's happened is every time the debt ceiling has come up, the Congress has argued about it, the president's chimed in, everything. And then usually they bump it up right away. But in 2011, there was a really big fight over it. Everybody held their ground, and there was a danger that that the United States government was basically going to have to shut down until they extended the debt limit. And the GOP vows there's not going to be any agreement on this until they get the spending cuts that they're asking for. And so this will probably come to a head, I'm guessing, at about the end of February. And then there are a couple more things down the road that we'll be talking about down the road.
We'll be covering that over the year, I'm sure, on Your Money and on the Joy Cardine Show and the Ideas Network in general. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin McKinley does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a question about your finances, planning for retirement, anything to do with On Your Money, give a call now at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, it's time for a visit to the On Your Money email box. Kevin, Jared brought some I-bonds. At your recommendation, he bought them. And now he wants to know about reporting the interest on those bonds. He asks how and when it's taxed, and if he can alternate between reporting and delaying reporting the taxable interest. I have no idea. What about you, Kevin?
I'm a little concerned that people are actually taking our advice here on the show.
Yeah, we never really thought that would happen.
Follow through that. I guess I should have been more cautious about the kind of advice I was giving. Good idea, Jared. I-bonds, United States Series I savings bonds, are one of our favorite investments. The I stands for inflation adjusted. They pay 1.76% interest right now, and that rate is adjusted every May 1st and November 1st. There's no state taxes at all on the interest, and the federal taxes that may be due, you kind of have a choice. It's a very odd situation, but you can either choose to pay taxes on the interest every single year as the bonds accrue, or wait until either you redeem the bonds or they finally mature, which can be 30 years out. So you get kind of a choice on your bond when you take it out. Say, I'm either going to pay the taxes every single year on the interest, or I'll just wait till I cash it in or pull it out, which creates some opportunities, but also some questions like Jared's.
Well, and so how do you decide? How can you make up your mind, and how can you change your mind?
You have to decide really the first year in which you earn the interest. You get some information from the Treasury, usually a 1099, that says this interest has been credited to the account. And once you do it annually, if you do choose to declare year by year, you do have to declare it year by year for every year, not only for that bond, but for all of your other savings bonds that you own, plus any future bonds that you might buy. So if you do decide to go with the annual reporting and taxation, you're really stuck with that method pretty much for the rest of your life on all of your savings bonds.
So you're locked in when you decide up front like that.
That's correct.
And do you have any suggestions on which method is best?
Well, the easiest one is, of course, just to delay the taxation until you actually cash the bond in or it matures. It means you don't have to report the interest, and you don't have to pay taxes on it right now, and you only have to do it when you need the money later on and when you're cashed the bond in. And by definition, hopefully, needing the money means you're in the lower income tax bracket because you have lower income, and therefore you won't pay as much on the bond as you would if you were to do it day by day. But you can go to treasurydirect.gov. They have a fairly helpful page that describes all the different options that you have, the different requirements. Treasurydirect.gov, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
It's Kevin McKinley, financial planner. It's this week's edition of On Your Money, and we'll go to the phones now with Kim in Mequon. Hi, Kim.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing today?
Good. I just have a quick question. Just yesterday I received like a $20,000 inheritance check, and I'm wondering if it makes more sense that we have a HELOC loan for a second home that we have up north. Does it make more sense to pay off the HELOC loan that's about $20,000, or just kind of save that money and just put it in the bank?
All right. Straightforward
question.
Kim. Yeah.
Are either, when you say we, I mean you, are you assuming you and your husband? Is that what you mean by we?
Yeah.
Okay, and are either of you working?
Oh, both of us.
Both of us. Okay, are you maxing out your pre-tax retirement plan savings at work?
No.
Okay, if you're not, I'd much rather have you put that money into work, because what will happen is for every, let's say you have $20,000 and you decide, you know what we're going to do? We're going to increase our contributions to what we're saving at work in our retirement plans, and then we're going to use our savings to offset the smaller paychecks that we're going to receive. You'll probably save about 10 to 20% of whatever you put into that plan in taxes, meaning that if you got an extra $20,000 into a pre-tax plan this year, you're actually going to save somewhere between $1,000 to $4,000 in income taxes the following April, because your income will be lower. Versus the interest on the home equity line of credit, Kim, that's probably about, what, maybe 4 or 5%?
Yeah, it's 5%.
Okay, if it's 5%, it's fairly high, but I would still rather have you keep that and just pay it off slowly. If interest rates do go up and the rate on that home equity line of credit goes up along with it too, then it may make better sense to do it. But until that rate gets to probably above 8 to 10%, I think you're better off saving as much as you can into your retirement plan and just making the minimum payments required on the home equity line of credit.
Thanks a lot for the call, Kim. Good luck making that decision. Rob Ferret talking to Kevin McKinley. It's this week's edition of On Your Money. We've got a couple open lines for you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Call in with your personal finance questions, and Kevin will take a stab at them. You can also send an email, onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm filling in for Joy Cardine this week. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Money's on Little Richard's mind, and it's on my mind and your mind, too. We're talking to Kevin McKinley. It's this week's edition of On Your Money. We're answering your personal finance questions. To be precise, Kevin's answering your personal finance questions. I'm Rob Ferret. I'm just filling in for Joy Cardine this week here on the Ideas Network. Kevin, let's head back to the phones now. We've got David with us in Madison. Hi, David.
Morning. Kevin, longtime fan, first-time caller.
I like you better than the opposite, rather than the people who are longtime callers are just becoming fans of the show. So welcome, David.
All right.
Thank you for your kind
words.
We're
in. You bet. My wife and I were just discussing our life insurance policy, and we're debating who can we ask for this, and then you came on, so it's perfect timing. I believe, currently in a term life insurance plan where we pay a little bit more, get a little bit less, but the option that after 20 years, if hopefully we don't need to use the life insurance plan, we get it back. Is that term life insurance?
That's a type of term life insurance, yes.
Okay. We don't have a family yet, but would like one. Could you discuss the pluses and minuses of doing a term life insurance versus the alternative where we pay less per month, but could have a larger policy if needed?
Sure. The type that you have is term policy, but it's called return of premium usually. And what that means is you pay a bunch of money in over time, and if you never need it, then what happens is you get some of that money back. And often it can be your entire principal. It's usually... It's kind of a gimmick, but it's not a bad gimmick if that's what it takes for you to actually get life insurance that you need, David. So I'm okay with it. My preference is you get the term policy, but you actually just pay in, get the bare minimum, have it be just what you want it to be, which is term insurance that covers a lot. And by the way, and this may enter into your conversation with your wife, which can be very delicate conversations between couples. I know I'm married, and so is my wife. And when we're talking about things like life insurance, it's really delicate to see who actually brings up the subject. Like, you know, how much do I get if you die again? That's a question that you really have to be in a great space in your marriage and your relationship to bring that up without it leading to more discussions and heated discussions, if you will. So I'd like to see people have roughly maybe 200 times your monthly expenses in life insurance, and hopefully on each one of you. Sometimes insurance companies won't allow you to put that much in, but something along those lines so that you've got more than enough to pay off any debts that you have, pay for any future expenses, and then especially if you do decide to have children in the future, then that's when it really kicks in, because I not only want to have enough money so that the kids are provided for, but also so that if there's a surviving parent, the parent has the option of either staying home with the kid or hiring someone to do the things that the other parent was hopefully doing and isn't done anymore.
Okay.
Does that help you out, David?
Yes, yes. Because we've been advised that while we paid more into a term, maybe that money could be better spent or better invested in, say, Roth or other investments, and then pay less for a monthly life insurance plan.
Does that make sense, Kevin?
Yeah, that makes sense. And by the way, David, there's a really good site you can go to compare term life insurance policies. It's Term for Sale, T-E-R-M, the number 4, and then S-A-L-E.com, termforsale.com. And again, we have that link up at onyourmoney.com, and we'll make sure it's prominently featured later on this afternoon.
David, thanks a lot for the call. The other delicate part of that, Kevin, apart from bringing up the issue of how much money do you get if the other one dies, you've got to watch for who's more enthusiastic when they say that.
Yeah, that's right. And especially you'll note on a lot of those, you know, Dateline 48-hour shows where there's a mystery over the missing spouse. Mm-hmm. And often the topic of life insurance comes up either right before or right after the spouse goes missing. And mm-hmm. So, yes, it's a very... You don't want to say, where is the policy? How much do you have? Can you get more? And can you get it very quickly? All of those questions should be red flags in a relationship.
Words to live by. Thanks for the call, David. We'll go now to Pat in Madison. Hi, Pat.
Hi, good morning. Say, my mom is a senior, and she moved out of her house, her home of something like 60 years, into a senior apartment. And I understand, and she does intend to sell the house at some point, but my understanding is, there's a certain number of years during which if she sold it, she would get a capital gains benefit. But beyond that number of years, and I think it might be 3 or 4, if she's not living in the house and she sells it after that time, she won't benefit from the capital gains, break or whatever that is. Can you kind of confirm that for me, Kevin, and explain it a little bit?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think that the topic you're looking for is 701. You go to irs.gov and they just type in topic 701 and they have it laid down. But basically what it is, do you know how much gains she might have on the home?
You're talking about the percentage that she would...
what's the dollar amount? Do you know?
The value of the house?
Is she going to make money on it? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's all paid for. So okay. I think, yeah.
But is she going to sell it
for... capital gain?
Yeah, go ahead, Kevin. Sorry.
Thank you, Rob. the difference between the what she paid for it versus what she sold for it, that's going to be the capital gain. And she can exclude up to $250,000 of that gain from her income. She's single. Is that correct, Pat?
My dad passed away. And, she'd have 100% of the sale, I guess. Or
okay. Yeah. Okay, she has to have it be her primary home for at least 2 out of the 5 years prior to the sale. So if she's, let's say it's been her home for 2 years, but then she moved 3 years ago. In theory, anyway, if she sold it today, she could qualify for the capital gains exclusion. And I would say this, do you have a rough idea of what she might sell the house for, or what it might be worth?
Yeah, I think it's about $150,000.
Okay. And depending on what she paid for it way back when, let's say she paid $50,000 for it, well, she'd have $100,000 or so of capital gains. Even if she didn't qualify for the exclusion, the chances are that she would be in a very low capital gains tax rate right now because of the extension to the laws that we were referring to previously. And she might owe, I would say maybe, again, I'm just guessing here, Pat, but I'm saying she might owe maybe $5,000 to $15,000 at the most in capital gains taxes on that sale, even if she didn't qualify for the exclusion. So, you know, that can be not by, the realtor's commission, depending on what you get for the place. And so while it's certainly something I would be conscious of, I wouldn't obsess on it versus just deciding, hey, this is the right time to sell the house. She needs to get out of it, and we need the money for it. So I think you should get the best price you can for it, sell it when you're ready for it, and then I think you're going to be able to avoid a lot of the taxes of it. But even if you can't, it's a lot of money, but as a percentage of the proceeds, it's probably not as bad as what you think it might be.
Thanks for the call, Pat. We've had a couple lines open up now at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. If you have a personal finance question for financial planner Kevin McKinley, now's a great time to call, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. John is with us next in Dubuque. Hi there, John.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have a question regarding EE savings bonds. 10 years ago when my grandson was born and 6 years ago when my granddaughter was born, I invested into EE savings bonds for them each at that time, $5,000 each. With where the market's been and the economy, I'm just wondering if that's the best method for that money to just leave those bonds ride, or if there would be something else for those children at their ages today of 6 and 10 that they could roll that over into or change it into a better investment.
Sure. It's actually, do you know what the interest rate offhand is, John, on those bonds and what you're earning on them?
Oh, boy, I'm sorry, I don't. I was on my way to work this morning and heard you were on and just wanted to kind of run that by you. You know, 6 and 10
well,
years
that's
ago.
No excuse. That's no excuse, John, but we will wait for you to get to work and then call the bank and see what. No, they that's understandable. And most people don't, in part because, like you said, this was several years ago. So it's understandable. I'm guessing the interest rate on those bonds, John, is actually pretty good. And especially because interest rates have fallen so much in the last few years, those EE bonds probably haven't dropped as much. And so, because they're very, very safe investments relative to most other options out there, and because the rate is pretty good, I would not cash those in at this time, especially if you are thinking about using them for college, I would guess, and the kids maybe in the next few years.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I think they had a 20-year maturity on them, and so I was thinking at that time when, you know, I put the money away for them that, you know, if they incurred student loans in the future, yes, that they could use that money for that.
You can use 529 college savings plans to save specifically for college. There are some tax incentives to it, but oftentimes the safe investment options probably don't pay as much as those savings bonds do, and the more aggressive ones may earn you more, but they may also lose money as well, too. And you have a fairly narrow window. It's not like saving for retirement. You know, you only have maybe 5 to 10 years to save for the kids' college, and then that money's going to be exhausted relatively quickly within, you know, hopefully 3 to 4 years if they can get out of school by then. So I probably lean in this instance toward just keeping it for them. One thing you might want to consider, John, is if they do get jobs in the future in high school, whether it's babysitting, mowing lawns, paper route, McDonald's, whatever, you may want to use that income as the basis for a Roth IRA contribution for them. And then at that time, cash in the bonds, use the proceeds to fund the Roth IRA for them. And that can serve as not only a nice short-term savings account if they need the money in the future, but also it's a great long-term retirement savings account for a teenager because they'll have 40 to 50 years, hopefully, to have that money grow, and then it will be tax-free in retirement. But for the time being, I'd just as soon have you hang on to those EE bonds.
Thanks a lot for the call, John. Let me ask you a follow-up, Kevin. You say you should hang on to those bonds he bought 6 or 10 years ago. What if you're in the position today of making the initial decision to maybe buy those EE bonds for the kids? Would it make sense to do that now?
That's a good question, Rob, and I would say no. I would prefer you go with the I bonds instead. The EE bonds have a fixed rate now that is extremely low, and it's fixed forever, so it won't go up at all, even if interest rates do rise in the future. The I bonds not only pay a higher interest rate right now, but that rate could also go higher in the future, especially if inflation and interest rates do go up as well. So, no, I'd much rather have people get the Series I savings bonds instead of the EEs.
We'll go next to Guy in Hartford. Hi, Guy.
Hi.
What's your question?
Couple callers ago, she called in with this $20,000 she had, and she had a debt on a loan. I guess the way I was brought up, you know, you pay your debts first. Why wouldn't you give the advice or, you know, like the other two big radio people, investment people or advice people, say pay off the debt, you know, live debt free, and you know, then save. You know, what is the advantage of just keep on paying and doing the Roth?
Gotcha. Thanks, Guy. Why not pay off our debt, Kevin?
Well, first of all, guys, big mistake here is listening to other personal finance radio shows, right?
I'm a little confused. Are there other ones?
I don't know. Even after the first of the year, I thought that they ruled those out, but apparently they still exist. No, Guy, that's a very good question, and it's a common question. And it actually, for people who, as we say, were either raised on a farm or raised by people who were raised on a farm or so on and so on, getting out of debt always seems to be like a primary sensible goal. And it usually is, especially if you do not trust yourself to use money that would otherwise be used to pay off debt wisely, meaning that you say, you know, if I don't pay this off, I'm just going to spend it on something dumb. But otherwise, interest rates on just about every single type of long-term loan, other than credit cards, are very low right now. And so interest is not as big of a potential threat to people paying interest as liquidity is, meaning being able to get at money if you need it in an emergency or if you need to. A lot of people are paying off their mortgages quickly, and they're using money that could otherwise be used to save for retirement, like we spoke with some of the other callers. They would save more in taxes by putting that money into their pre-tax retirement plans than they would save in interest by paying off the loan. And in these very uncertain, volatile times, which I don't see things getting easier and more certain anytime soon, I'd much rather have people have liquidity and be able to make all of their monthly payments and expenses on time and worry about interest costs as kind of a secondary or even, bear with me here, tertiary goal, rather than just trying to get rid of debt as quickly as possible. And again, especially if it's low interest rate debt like mortgages and some car loans and even some student loans have a very low interest rate debt, and you're better off saving money not only for short-term expenses but also retirement until you get that built up to the maximum amount you can. And then and only then would I want you to start paying the debt off.
And you've been making the point since you started doing this show, Kevin, that in the tough economy, if you've paid off your debt and then you lose your job, it's really hard to borrow that money back at that point.
Yes, sir. That's exactly right. And if you've been listening, Rob. Thank you. You're the one.
I caught it a couple times. Yeah.
All right. Read the transcribed notes. That's very true. And just because jobs and incomes and investments and all those things are so uncertain, it's not going to be. I hope most people, when people say, you know, I could pay this mortgage off right now, why won't I do that? Well, I hope people go through, you know, 20 or 30 years and their biggest problem financially and personally is, oh, shoot, nothing bad happened. I never needed that money. And then I ended up paying 3% interest on it or whatever. But if anything else goes on with that, or if interest rates go up, or if you find something that the money could have otherwise be better spent on, you'll be happy you paid all that debt off as slowly as possible.
Thanks for the call, Guy. It's time for our Smart Assets segment this week. Kevin, the new year brings us some new numbers that are going to affect our taxes, our investments, and our personal finances. What's in the works?
Oh, there's all kinds of fun things here. And this is why one of the reasons I love my job. I can just about guarantee that there will be new confusing laws and regulations and changes just about every single year, which people will have to call in and ask about. Some of the changes were already scheduled and were already took place, and others were part of the recent legislation. So let's talk a little bit about what they are, but not only what the changes have been, but also who and how and when they should be taken advantage of. And it's going to affect workers, retirees, and everybody else. And the most important numbers that we need haven't been determined yet for 2013.
Well, you mentioned retirees. Let's start there.
You'll actually get a little bigger Social Security check. If you are collecting Social Security, there was a 1.7% increase over last year's check. And the average retirement check in right now for Social Security is about $1,230. And so that might mean about another $20 or so per month. That's the good news. However, you'll also probably pay a little bit more in higher Medicare premiums if you qualify. And especially if you are a high-income retiree, your premium costs will be going up probably more than the amount of your increase Social Security check. Also, and this was one we had a call about right at the end of the year in 2012, there was a provision that really expired
at the end of the year, where people over the age of 7.5 could transfer money directly from their IRA to a qualified charity, and it would go tax-free even if they did not itemize. That expired at the end of the year, but it was renewed not only for 2013, but retroactively. So technically, you could still make that RMD distribution to a charity for 2012, and it would count as tax-free. It's going to be pretty tricky. We will talk more about it down the road.
That's retirees. What about people who are working now?
You are going to experience a little more pain, as we mentioned. You're not only going to have higher Social Security taxes. The average American full-time worker is going to pay about $1,000 more in Social Security taxes this year than they would have last year. Also, people have a higher earnings subject to Social Security taxes. The first $113,700 of earnings each year are going to be subject to Social Security. And you're going to have higher Medicare taxes if you make more than $250,000. Married filing jointly and $200,000 single. There's a 9% Medicare, or 0.9% rather, Medicare surtax that you'll go on. But the good news is you can set aside more for retirement in your pre-tax plans and your Roth IRAs. Those all bumped up $500. It's $17,500 is the max for 401ks and 403bs. Another $5,500 on top of that if you're over 50. And this will be a big thing for 2013's tax year. IRA and Roth IRA contribution limits have risen as well. So now you can contribute $5,500 per person for 2013, and then another $1,000 on top of that if you're over 50. But again, you can't do that for the 2012 tax year, just for the 2013 year.
And any laws that apply to all of us?
A few changes. A few laws stayed the same. There is a higher income tax rate at the top. That went from 35% to 39.6%. That's only over about $400,000 of earnings for single people. Plus, there's a new surcharge on investment income, a 3.8% surcharge. But again, that's only for investment income and people that only make more than a few $100,000 a year. There is a limit on the amount of money that can be given each year to an individual. That went from $13,000 up to $14,000. Capital gains taxes stay relatively the same, except for the people in the top brackets. And then the estate tax was a big issue in the news and politically. It doesn't affect a lot of people. That exempt amount, meaning people will pass estates on at this amount with no estate tax, remains at $5.12 million. The rate goes up a little bit from 35 to 40%. But again, that's one of those things that if you have that problem, it's a good problem to have.
And those are the things we know. Are there important figures that we don't know yet? If I can quote Donald Rumsfeld, what are the known unknowns?
What do we know that we don't know
exactly
right now? That is the income levels that determine what your federal tax bracket will be, and especially for the 15 to 25%. That's the one that can really affect which ways you should save for retirement, how much you should save for retirement, and how much and what sources you should use to fund your retirement once you've done. And so hopefully we'll get those figures fairly soon because they're fairly important.
And I guess we'll be talking about those when they come out.
Yes, sir.
All right. That's Kevin McKinley, financial planner. It's this week's edition of On Your Money. Time for some more of your questions at 800-642-1234. Your personal finance questions. Need some advice? Kevin may well have some for you. 800-642-1234 or onyourmoney@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My mama told me you better shop around. People make New Year's resolutions about losing weight almost as much as they resolve to improve their finances. We'll spend a few minutes talking about ways to spend less while you lose more. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine. Kevin McKinley is with us for this week's edition of On Your Money. Kevin, over the next couple of weeks, actually, you're going to talk about ways to save money while losing weight. What's going on in part one?
Well, we'll start with those supposed diet foods, Rob. These are those shakes, those bars, the entrees, pre-made entrees and little snacks that, in theory, you eat these and then you lose weight by eating them or something. I'm not really sure. But in any event, if you are tempted to buy these, there are lots of good alternatives out there that are much less expensive than the so-called diet food.
Now, there's some of those diet drinks out there that are pretty expensive, aren't they?
Yeah, they run about $2 a bottle or so. They're supposed to make you slim and fast.
Quickly.
They offer you some protein and a little bit of fiber, some vitamins, etc. It's much better off to go with skim milk, skim chocolate milk or 1% chocolate milk if you like a little flavor there. And then if you need some extra fiber and vitamins, a few, you know, a handful of nuts or maybe some high fiber breakfast cereal eaten along with it too. And generally per serving, instead of $2 a bottle, you'll pay about 20 cents per serving. You'll still get a lot of the same calcium and protein, et cetera, and the fiber. So right there, that's about a 90% discount over the more expensive version.
And then there are those energy and nutrition and diet bars. I'm not a dieter myself, but I've eaten some of those as a snack. Some of those are pretty good, aren't they?
They're not too bad. And again, they offer more, you know, fiber and protein as well, but they also cost a couple dollars or so each on average. You're much better off from a cost basis anyway to go with a slice of whole wheat bread, toast it if you must, but then put on a couple tablespoons of peanut butter and you will get a lot of the fiber and a lot of the protein that you get from those bars and a lot less chemical ingredients. And I actually did the math on this. Oftentimes, if that's a little too dry for you, you can make yourself a little peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And even though the jelly offers no nutrient value, often you'll still have less sugar overall in the peanut butter and jelly sandwich than you will in some of these so-called nutrition bars.
Kevin, you may be starting a diet revolution. You're saying you take a piece of bread, wheat bread,
yes,
and you put on
get a piece of paper,
buttered peanuts. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to follow this. And jelly, and I put them all together?
Well, this is one of the reasons second graders are a lot thinner than many adults, I think, is because they choose to have this on three times a day.
I'm going to play some music for a couple minutes while I digest that information. I think we better move on. I'll just come back to that. Now, let's look at those frozen diet entrees. Again, for some reason, I've eaten some of these. Again, not a dieter, but they're not so bad. And you got to admit, they're convenient. They're more convenient than cooking our own meal at home.
Also much more expensive anyway. And again, you're looking at probably $2 to $3. And if you take a really good look at these entrees, often the low-calorie feature really comes not from anything magical or special in the ingredients, but it's because the portion sizes are so small, which, again, makes it, you know, even more expensive than if you were to do this on your own. And one of our favorite kitchen tools is the crock pot. You can make dinner not only just for that night when you get home, throw some meat and vegetables and some liquid and some spices in there, and you'll have a nice stew when you get home, and then you can freeze it in individualized portions. So, and again, you're probably looking at about 10 to 20 cents per serving and a lot less ingredients in it, and you know exactly what went into it, and you can take it to work and put it in the microwave and annoy your coworkers.
I'm a big fan of the crock pot because it's almost no work. And what comes out makes it look like you actually cooked something. You actually did something.
It really does. And we actually have Cooking Light has about 150 crock pot recipes that are lower in calorie. You can go to tinyurl.com/crockpotcl to find all those recipes. And we'll have that up at onyourmoney.com too.
And how about some low-cost snacks that might be better than the donut I'm going to go over and get in about 15 minutes from now?
Moment on the lips, lifetime, yeah, whatever. A lot of people choose to munch on, you know, low-fat crackers or worse yet, rice cakes. Or if, you know, you still have some packing material left over from holiday presents that gives you
similar
about the
texture.
Same level of satisfaction and nutrition. Rice cakes cost dozens of dollars per pound and really don't provide a whole lot of satisfaction. So if you need something to munch on, again, one of the On Your Money favorite kitchen tools is an air popper. Costs about $20 or so. Buy the whole kernel corn. You can get, it works out to about a penny per serving, and you do get a little bit of fiber and protein out of it. And if just, you know, salt and butter isn't enough for you, you're trying to watch your calories, you can go to kernelseasons.com, kernel with a K, kernelseasons.com. And they not only have about two dozen different flavorings that you can order there, but they also have recipes on how you can make your own flavorings at home.
Rob Ferret talking to financial planner Kevin McKinley. It's this week's edition of On Your Money. Back to your calls now. We have Gene in Knapp. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Yeah, good.
Oop, can you pick up the phone, Gene? Speaker.
Yeah, yeah,
there you go.
Yeah. Quick question. Make sure I get the tax structure understood. That, you know, until I make over $200,000, I pay the same rate as everyone else. And even after I. All the monies under $200,000 are at the same rate as everybody else.
Does he have that
yes,
right,
sir,
Kevin?
That's exactly right. Yeah, he does. And it, Gene, it's one of the things that kind of got misconstrued, if you will, by the political process and some of the back and forth is, oh, your taxes are going up. Well, the taxes are going up for just about everybody, but it's workers, and it's usually because the Social Security payroll holiday expired, not because your actual federal income tax rates were being raised. And again, now for people who make more than $200,000 and more than $400,000 and other times, yes, tax rates will be going up, but it's only on the incomes over those dollar amounts. So it's a great question, Gene.
Thanks a lot for the call, Gene. We'll go now to Bill in Greendale. Hi there, Bill.
Hello. How are you this morning?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Very fine. I'm concerned. I have a question for Kevin. I'm concerned that in 2012, we as people who are over 70 and a half and had to make required minimum withdrawals from our IRAs were not allowed to make qualified charitable deductions. I understand that when the Cliff business was finally settled on the 30th or whatever it was of December, there was a window from the 10th or 11th of December through the 31st of January, that allows us to use our qualified required minimum withdrawal IRAs to give them to a qualified charitable organization.
Huh. Is that, does he have that right, Kevin?
Yep. He actually has that correct. Good for you, Bill, not only for paying attention, but for having a spot in your heart for some benevolence for a qualified organization. People over the age of 70 and a half are generally required to take at least their required minimum distribution from their IRA accounts. But many people either don't need the money or would like to donate it. And so they can make that distribution directly to a charity. And even if they don't itemize, they can still avoid paying taxes on it, or better yet, having it added to their taxable income. So, yes, not only can you do that in 2013, but you can even do it for 2012 as long as you get it done by the end of January of 2013. So, Bill, stop listening to the show right now. Call your favorite charity. Tell them that you're interested in doing that, and I'm sure that they will scramble to make sure you get it done by the 31st of this month.
Thanks for the call, Bill. We've got some pretty smart listeners here, Kevin. It's almost like they have some source of advice about financial information that they check in with. Do you think they're going online or something?
No, they're probably listening to those two other shows that guy was referring to.
Back to the phones now, and maybe time for another call or two at 800-642-1234. We've got Lynn in Racine with us. Hi, Lynn.
Good morning, gentlemen. This is my question. I am trustee for a trust for my deceased uncle. My cousin is the beneficiary. If we need money, like for taxes or living expenses, would it be wiser to cash in those double E bonds or to draw from the stocks and bonds that he has, his investments?
I'm sorry, were the stocks and bonds within a retirement account or were they held outside of like an IRA?
They were outside of an IRA.
Okay. My guess is that you'll probably owe less in taxes on the stocks and bonds because they usually get what's known as a step up in the cost basis, meaning the cost of the day that the person died is the new cost basis. So if and when you choose to sell them, you only pay potential capital gains taxes on the difference between what you sell them for now and what the price was on the day the person passed away. And the double E bonds, do you know how old the double E bonds are?
The double E bonds are probably over 20 years old.
Okay. You're going to have to take those out sooner anyway, and I would check on those because technically with those double E bonds, when they stop earning interest, you have to start paying taxes on it. That's the law. You have to pay taxes on the accumulated interest if it's never come out. But if you said, I need some money in a hurry, I'd rather have you sell some of the stocks or bonds, check and see which ones will generate the least amount of capital gains right now. And some of them may even have a loss in there, if depending on what the prices have done. And then start doing the homework to figure out not only what you have to do to get the money out of the double E bonds, but what tax ramifications you have. And you're going to have to pay an accountant to kind of get this settled for you. It's worth it. But it's going to be very tricky because not only the fact that the interest probably hasn't been accounted for all these years, but also the fact that there's some changes that happen to the status of the bonds when a person passes them on to a beneficiary. So start with the stocks and bonds and then start working on the EE bonds for both liquidation and taxation.
Hope that helps, Lynn. Thanks for calling in. Here's an email from Stephen in Wauwatosa. Stephen emails, I have an issue that needs someone as smart as Kevin to help me work through. There's that false praise you're always looking for, Kevin. So
actually, I like that because it doesn't actually say I'm smart. It just says this requires the level of intelligence that he has.
Exactly, exactly. He could mean someone as dumb as a post or someone more brilliant than Einstein himself.
Even Kevin should be able to help me with this.
All right, well, here it is. It's time to get a new car for my wife, Stephen says. I'm curious as to the positives and negatives of buying new versus used and financing versus leasing versus paying in cash. All right, apply every ounce of smarts you have to that one, Kevin.
Okay, let me get another sip of coffee here. All right, I'm ready to go. This falls along the lines of one of the other caller's questions about, hey, why would I keep debt when I have the money to do it? For most people, I would have you not only buy a new car, but I would also have you get a loan to purchase the new car. And here's why. The new car is probably going to be, depending on the type of car, is going to be less expensive than a used car. Not in terms of price, of course, but in terms of what you get for what you pay for. When you buy a new car, you do have some depreciation for it, but you have the same thing when you purchase a used car as well. The new car probably is more reliable, and if it's not more reliable, any things that go wrong with it are more likely to be covered by the manufacturer's warranty than it is to be from a used car. And also, you can get a better loan on a new car, lower interest rate, and a longer term. And then once you get that new car and that new car loan, your costs for that car are going to be pretty much fixed. It's going to be the payment every single month. And yes, you do have to make the payment, but it's much more reliable just to make the payment and much more predictable. If you buy a used car and you have problems with it, not only do you have to come up with the money to pay for the problems, but you also have to figure out either getting alternate transportation while the used car gets fixed. And if you finally say, yeah, I have a $3,000 car with $2,000 of repairs required for it, now you're stuck. And you have to then buy a new car, a replacement car, in a hurry, which just about guarantees you're probably not going to get a very good deal on it. We'll be talking more about this when the weather gets a little nicer. People start looking at getting a new car in the springtime. We're going to do a special segment on it probably in March or so. But no, offhand, I'd rather have you purchase a new car if you can afford it and trust yourself. And you can get a very low interest rate loan on that, probably about 4 to 6%. You should go to your local bank or credit union first before you take the loan from the dealership.
Quick email from Tracy. What do you mean, Kevin, when you say maxing out your employee retirement plan?
Good question, Tracy. Thank you very much. Maxing out your retirement plan at work means putting in as much as you possibly can up to the limits. And usually that means, again, for 2013, $17,500 in a 401k and then another $5,500 on top of that if you admit to being over 50 or your income, whichever is less. So we'll talk about some of the ways, Tracy, in the future that you can figure out what's the optimal dollar amount. But maxing out means putting in as much as you possibly and legally can.
Thanks for the emails, Tracy and Stephen. Kevin, just a minute left. Time for our website of the week.
If you are getting your finances in order, go to consumer.gov. It has a great setup. It's what I would do if I had the time and the money to put together a complete website with all the financial information you could possibly need on investing, spending, borrowing, interest rates, consumer.gov. And we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And I'm going to go way out on the limb and guess that you have four more words for us before we go.
Yes, spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, thanks a lot. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner. He has offices in Madison and Eau Claire. That's McKinley Money LLC. You can hear him virtually every Tuesday here on the Ideas Network at this time. Thanks to Bill Martins, Amanda Magnus, and Cynthia Schuster for producing today's shows. I'm Rob Ferret, filling in for Joy Cardine, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.